what I want to mention, just to get us started, is we've completed the first missionary journey. We know that. And it was, when I've looked it up, it said it was about 1,581 miles. So that's almost 1,600 miles, okay? Now, this second missionary journey, it's going to be about 3,050 miles. So it's going to be double that. And just to give us a perspective of how far this is, how long this is, I Googled Detroit to the Mackinac Bridge. Now, I didn't say Northwest Detroit, South Detroit. I just said Detroit, okay? And it said 299 miles, so let's say 300. So the first missionary journey was five times going up to the Mackinac Bridge. This missionary journey that we're going to be talking about tonight is going to be double that. So it's going to be 10 times that much. The point that I'm making is I just wanted to give you a little perspective as far as the mileage, as far as how much is going to be traveled at this point, just to give you a little perspective here.
And a lot of that was walking.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. The bulk of it was walking. However, there was some ships taken. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you've got ships being taken, what you also have is money. And I'm sure that there was some money that was given to them. But we're going to see that there was a lot of stuff that was done right at the time, at different times, I should say, where they provided their own money. They did some manual labor. They did some work themselves. And we're going to get into that, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyway, what I've called this lesson is always faithful. And I'm going to be doing some stone skipping. So allow me to do some stone skipping here. That's what these little things are here. It's going, you know, it's skipping along. We're doing some stone skipping here. And there's really just four things with the stone skipping. So maybe this won't, it's me, right? Maybe it won't take too long. And then again, who knows? But in Acts chapter 15, verse 36, Acts chapter 15, verse 36, we see that it says that after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let's return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are." This is not new. He did that all the time. He would go back to the cities. Remember, he went back to Lystra after in Derbe, where Courtney taught, he'd been stoned. So he goes back into Lystra. And you can imagine what he looked like to start off with. But the purpose was to strengthen them. And we see that he did that in chapter 15, verse 41. And we see that he does that twice in chapter 16, verse 5, and then again in verse 40. He goes back to where he was. You see, trouble weakens the new churches. But words of encouragement strengthens their resolve to live for Christ. So he goes back. And does not that do the same thing for us? Amen. When we come to church services? Amen. And we come to Bible school, Bible time? Because it is one of those things that troubles just do that to us. But we need to hear the word, and we need to be encouraged by the word, and we need to be loved on by each other. So that's something that he establishes. Now, the next stone is Acts chapter 16. And you'll say, "Day, that's a big stone." It is. It really, truly is a big stone, but it's a great one. Look at what it says here in Acts chapter 16. It says that when they came to Derbe, so when you look at your map again, You see, that's what's happening. They're retracing some steps here. They go to Derbe, and there he picks up Timothy. And one of the things I want to say about Timothy is he is a companion who is going to be with him longer than anyone else. There is no one with him the length of time that Timothy is with him. And as a matter of fact, he even to me, I say this from Hebrews chapter 13, verse 23, we see that he mirrors him, because at the end of Hebrews, it mentions that Timothy had been imprisoned and was now released, and they were rejoicing. But Timothy is with him longer than anybody else has been. Now, also we notice here It's verse 10. We begin the we verses. And when we see the we verses, it's talking about Dr. Luke. Now, I don't know where he joined him, but it'll mention that when they were passing by Mysia, and if you look at the map, somewhere in here is Mysia, and I've got a little thing that says somewhere in here Luke joins them. At least this is where he says he's joining them. So I don't know too much about that, but I do know that he joins them at this point. So we've got Timothy, we've got Silas, we've got Paul, and we've got Dr. Luke all on this journey. And it says that they go to, they end up going up to Troas. They pass by Mysia, they end up going to Troas. See where that's on the map? And Troas is going to be a jumping off point for them, because they are then going to go make their way over into Philippi. They hit a little bitty Samothrace, which is just a little bitty island, and Neapolis. But they make their way to Philippi. And we learned that in verse 12 that Philippi is now a Roman colony. And it's at the east end of what's called the Via Ignatia, that little strip that's going to connect Rome with the east. So what they've been doing all along is going on a Roman road. It's been a Roman road all along. It was the military road. And it also was a commercial road too, because at Derbe they've got some sort of a way station or something that you gotta, you know, probably gives, I don't know, this is me, yeah, pay something or other. That's the word, the toll, thank you. Fill in the blanks. Be my husband when I can't figure out the word. Throw it in there. But that's what it seems to be. So they go to Philippi. We see this wonderful, wonderful first European. Now we're in Europe. So I look around here somewhere. Our ancestry goes back to that. This is great. This, and Lydia becomes the first European convert. And she must be something pretty special, because she has a household. It's not just a matter of she's there in this little bungalow. She has a household. And she is a prominent businesswoman. So she may have a household in Thyatira also, some house. So they spend time there. And we see that as we continue to go through the book of Acts, we see that Paul and Silas gets imprisoned. And while they are there, and they're in the jail, and, you know, it always amazes me. It says, about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Isn't that wonderful? The prisoners were listening to them. We don't know about conversion. We're not told anymore. But don't you just know that the Spirit of the Lord was doing something there? And you know the story, how there's an earthquake, something happens, and the prisoner or the guard, he was ready to kill himself, and Paul and Silas says, don't, we're all here, it's okay. And he runs in, he says, sirs, what must I do to be saved? So we have this beautiful, beautiful account of the Philippian jailer's conversion. And then it continues on after this. It continues on that they go on to they go back to Lydia, and she's with them, and they just sort of take care of things there with her. And anyway, in verse 40, it says, "So they went out of the prison, visited Lydia, and when they had seen the brothers, they encouraged them and departed." There was always encouragement. They were always giving encouragement. And you can be assured it was encouragement from what we would call the Word now. But it was encouragement from Christ. It was encouragement from what they had been teaching and what they had taught them. And then they go, Paul and Silas goes to Thessalonica. And this is something, because it says in chapter 17, we're in 17 now, in verse 2, it says that they went for 3 days to the Sabbath, three Sabbaths, that they reasoned with them from the Scriptures. And the Jews were jealous. Many of them responded to this. And it says some of them were persuaded to join Paul and Silas, as did a great many, this is verse 4, of the devout Jews and not a few of the leading women. In other words, a good number. I don't know why he writes that way, but it's very, it underscores it by being simplistic, I guess. He says, not a few of them. It's like, you know what I mean by that? A lot of them. And anyway, it tells us in verse 5, the Jews were jealous, those that wouldn't listen to the gospel message, those that wanted nothing to do with it were jealous. And look at what they do. They go to Jason's house, where obviously they were staying, where Paul, Barnabas, Silas, Timothy, not Barnabas, Paul and Silas, Timothy and Dr. Luke were staying. And they go in there go to Jason's house seeking to bring them out, it says. And I want you to see this. They drag out Jason and the brothers, some of the brothers before the city authorities. And look at verse 6. These men who have turned the world upside down have come here also. You know, they're telling that as a derogatory thing. Isn't it beautiful? I mean, seriously, it really is beautiful. These guys that turned the world upside down, they're here. They're here. And it tells us that poor Jason and the guys that they took, the other brothers, the other believers, whoever they had pulled out, they had to post bail. That's actually what they did. It says that they basically posted bail. And so it says that the brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. And you've just got to look this out. And I want you to see what Luke describes about the Bereans. Again, they go to the Jewish synagogue. And notice he says, now these Jews were more noble than those in Thessalonica. And the word noble here does not have anything to do with their birthright, like their nobility. The word here, the Greek word noble here, means open-minded, fair, thoughtful. That's how Luke sees them, because they receive Paul's message, notice what it says, with all eagerness, examining the Scriptures daily to see if these things were so. They took the authority of the written Old Testament word as being their authority. So he calls them noble, and that was their final authority. He calls them noble. Now, again, it says many of them believe, with not a few of the Greek women of high standing as well as men. So you know there was a lot of them, and these old Thessalonica Jews, they come back agitating, stirring up the crowd. Verse 14, it says, and the brothers immediately sent Paul off his way to the sea. But Silas and Timothy remained there. Those who conducted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and after receiving a command for Paul, or for Silas and Timothy, to come as soon as possible, they departed. Now, the point that I'm wanting to make here is that Paul is now alone. There is no one with him. No one with him. It even says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 1, he says, I sent Timothy to check on you, basically is what it says. And he's making reference to this. He sent him back to Thessalonica. We know that for sure. We're not positive where Silas or Dr. Luke went, but very possibly to go back to Berea and maybe even Philippi. But they were not with him. He is totally alone now. And that's one of the things I want you to, you know, I want to really make you realize that this is in his aloneness, all alone. Matthew Henry says, the zealous advocate for the cause of Christ will be ready to plead for it in all companies as occasion offers. And what has happened here, Paul has ministered, Paul has evangelized the religious, he's evangelized the pagan. Remember in Lystra, what Courtney talked about? They were totally pagan. They were looking to make them, that they had been the gods that had come down, and they were wanting to do sacrifices to them. And they had to just, they barely stopped them. The way I remember the things saying is that it was all they could do to keep them from treating them like gods. They fought that. They fought that. So now he is going to be in the position of dealing with the philosophers, the intelligentsia, if you will, the educated elite, because he's come to Athens. And while he has come to Athens, there's just a little bit of, well, I don't know anything else to call it, but a little bit of background, and I want to just pull back for a minute. The classical Greek period was from about 551 to 321 BC. So Paul's here somewhere, it depends, because you can read that he was there anywhere from 49 to 52 that this journey took. From 49 to 52 or from 48 to 51. What I'm getting at is he's in the first century, in the mid-first century. And classical Greek period was an academic center of the ancient world. You had Socrates, you had Plato, you had Aristotle, Archimedes, and I mean, you had all of this going on. And even in their background, you had Pythagoras, who... I mean, I didn't like, huh?
Yeah,
Pythagorean theory. Yes, yeah. Math is not my thing. But I know that it's still being taught. All the different things that he has pointed out about angles and the different theorems and that. And you had Hippocrates, for heaven's sakes. You took a Hippocratic oath when you became a nurse, when you became a doctor. You know this. And he did a tremendous amount of things in medicine itself anyway. And anyway, this was just a think tank type of a thing. I mean, this was, or it's not yet, it's going to be. But anyway, now it's in its decline. That was, 300 years ago. It's in its decline. It's a tourist attraction. It's literally a tourist attraction, and it's especially for the intelligentsia and for the educated elite. And it was just one of those things that people wanted to come and see, even if they weren't Greeks, they wanted to come and see it. I don't know if you'll remember this, Linda, but Jerome, back in the beginning of the 1800s, Jerome in Arizona was absolutely full of miners. And I mean, it was a raucous town. absolutely raucous, because there was gold, there was silver, there was copper in them thar mines. And when they came to town, you better believe they, I mean, it was known as the most raucous town. And now they've turned it into more of a tourist attraction where you can come. We ate at the Haunted Hamburger. Because there's ghosts all around, too, you know. But that's what this had become. Athens had literally become a tourist attraction. Now, the highest point of elevation in a city was always given over to the city's patron god or goddess. And up high at the highest point was this temple to Athena. Athena, Athens, come on, you know. But there was this temple. And the architecture back in those days, the architecture was just astounding, absolutely astounding. And so what would happen is people would come here because it was literally a tourist attraction. What I want to do is I want to read Acts 16 through 21, and then there's some words here we need to look at. Acts 16, and we're going to go through 21.
You mean chapter 17?
In chapter 17, yes. In chapter 17, we're going to look at verse 16. Thank you. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, he's alone. Keep that in mind. He is alone. While Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. All right, let's go back, because I've got five words, well, six, counting both the Stoics. But the first word is the word provoked. Now, to me, provoked means agitated, you know. Don't provoke me. Don't agitate me. Don't upset me. You know, this sort of thing. Don't disgust me. But provoked is a very strong word. And in the Greek, it's a deep, profoundly visceral gut reaction. And it made him want to do something about it. So this isn't just, "You're upsetting me a little." He was, you know, he was just hit hard right to his soul, right through him. And then it mentions the marketplace. This was called the Agora. The marketplace, and different, all the cities had an Agora. Different towns, different cities would have an Agora, which was the marketplace. That's where you came for your souvenirs. That's where you came for, you know, you got your hot dogs and your you know, your cheesecake and what all they had, whatever they had. And that's where you came and you were just together as a group. And then it talks about, well, maybe I ought to say something about the marketplace. Sproul, R.C. Sproul, says very specifically that he was making tents there, just getting in the crowd, and he was going to be talking about Jesus and giving his gospel presentation while he made tents. I have a hard time thinking that that is so. I don't mean that he may not have taken some of his tools that you can repair tents with, and maybe even some of the silica that you would take that could repair it, you know, that sort of stuff. But I would think that he would have a very difficult time to break into the gills, those that actually did make the tents. One of the things that he says in 2 Thessalonians 3:6, he makes mention to them in Thessalonica. He said, I didn't take anything from you. I worked. I did things that brought about money for me, and I supported myself, and I did this to be an example to you. What did I say? 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 6. And then if we go into chapter 18, we even see in verses 3 through 4, he meets up with Priscilla and Aquila, who themselves are tent makers, and they do some tent making. What I'm getting at is my husband has a cousin whose older aunts that aren't related to us at all live down in Tennessee. And there was a visiting preacher that would come in, and they're older, and they don't, you know their minds aren't quite right. He'd knock on their door, and he'd say, I need a little kale. And they'd give him $2,000 or $3,000, and off he'd go. Next time he'd come to town, I need some kale. And my husband's cousin, he tried to chase him down one time and get him. I'm just glad he didn't get him. But anyway, he says, that's not what I am. I didn't get anything at all from you. I supported myself. And it was to be an example to you. Don't be an idler. Don't be someone that expects someone else to do it. And then he does talk about idling there and that. And the next word I've got here is Epicureans and Stoics. These were the two main philosophies in Athens. And these were absolutely the intelligentsia here. The Epicureans, they were from a line, the one that founded it hundreds of years before was Epicurus. And they believed that God existed, but God wasn't interested, wasn't even involved with humanity. There's a God, you know. I mean, they would go and they'd take their sacrifices to Athena, and they'd take, if they were in some other town, they'd take their sacrifices, you know, and they'd burn. God's not really interested in you. Their main purpose of life was pleasure. Avoid pain. Pleasure was the chief goal of man. You know that Calypso song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. I'm not going to sing it for you, but that's kind of what they were. Then there were the Stoics. And the Stoics were those that had evolved from Zeno. And Zeno, they were called Stoics because he would go into the colonnades of the temple there, like where Athena was, in those beautiful columns, and that was called the Stoa. So they became called the Stoics. And the Stoics' worldview was that God was the world's soul. Goal of life was to rise above all things, show no emotional response to either pain or pleasure. It was just always the same. Always the same. And if I were to have an emoji, I would have the Epicureans like this, a little round circle, two eyes, and like that. If you were to have the emoji of the Stoics, I'd have a round circle, two eyes, and nothing else. Just, I'm there. Totally opposite. I mean, you don't get any oppositor. I know that's not a word, but you don't get any more different than they are. These were the Epicureans and the Stoics. Then he says, then the other word was they wanted to know what this babbler wished to say. And I want to tell you something about the word babbler. It's not found in any other Greek literature. It's just here. But the word babbler, according to Vine's Expository Dictionary, was a crow or some other bird that waited for all the birds to get finished, and whatever they had left over, they would go and get it. And it was used of a man accustomed to hanging about the streets and the markets, picking up scraps which would fall from the loads or fall from the barrels or fall, somehow they would fall from things. They were looked at as a parasite who lived at the expense of others, really, just hangers on. And metaphorically, it became used, and that's how it's used here, it became used of a man who picks up scraps of information and retails them secondhand. In other words, a plagiarist. Someone that takes a little bit of this and a little bit of that, puts it together, and says that this is something new. I've got you something here. And it was used and intended to be a slang. It was Athenian slang. So he says, let's find out what this babbler has to say. This parasite, this one that's bringing about things and putting them together. Let's see what he has to say. And
that has anything to do with Babel?
Well, I
root does.
And we'll consider that. Yeah, and notice what I said here about what Matthew Henry said. They asked about Paul's doctrine, not because it was good, but because it was new. Look at verse 21. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. Now, let's go ahead and read verses 22 through 24, because then there's something else I want to point out. He says, so Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. Now, we have to say something about what an Areopagus is. If you were to take the Greek word Areopagus, it means high, aero, and then polis, city, the high point of the city. So while the marketplace was down lower, the Areopagus was up higher, closer to the temple of Athena, closer up there. And at one time, the Areopagus actually had a judicial function. It was the highest court in Greece, for civil, for religious, for political matters. But under Roman rule now, it still remained an important meeting place where philosophy and religion and law were discussed. Now, in the Roman era, it was called Mars Hill, as opposed to Areopagus. So you might see that reference to Mars Hill sometime, but it means the same thing. And you notice what happens here. He begins where the listeners are, and then he presents the gospel message in a very logical, biblical fashion. Starting with verse 24, he does an exposition of the character and the nature of God. Look at this. He said, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet, he is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. Even as some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now, as I pointed out here, I want you to see what he does, how he presents his message. He starts with creation. In the beginning, God. And I want to tell you, because I think Scripture tells us, I know it does, if you get that right, you're on the road to being right. In the beginning, God, capital G. You've got creation that's mentioned here. And that's what I point out. In the beginning, God, you've got creation mentioned here. Then he says in the next verse, he says, the God who, he's Lord of heaven and earth. He's not served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. There is a sense here of common grace. Common grace. Jesus spoke about this. In Matthew 5:45, he talked about the Father who is in heaven. He makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. Luke chapter 6, verse 35 says almost the same thing. Jesus is talking about the Most High, and of course, that's God. He is kind to the ungrateful and evil. In John chapter 3, verse 27, it says, a person cannot receive even one thing unless it is given him from heaven. You realize that? Not one thing. I was talking to somebody recently who told me they had talked to their brother and said something to the effect of, well, God gave you that opportunity to have this journeyman job. And he said to her, I did that all by myself. I pulled myself up by the bootstraps. That was me. And it floored her so much she couldn't even answer him, because she knew how he had been raised too. But that's what this thing, we don't get anything unless it's given to us from heaven. Nothing unless it's given to us from heaven. Psalm 145 verses 15 and 16 says this. This is talking about the Lord, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, and that is Jehovah. That's the big name for God. It's he who works in redemptive history. But it says, the eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food in due season. You open your hand. You satisfy the desire of every living thing. You know, if you have family, if you have friends, if you have people that you love in your life, they're from the Lord. That's common grace. He gives common grace. And the next thing I want to point out is verse 26 was sovereignty. Look at verse 26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. This is sovereignty. This is pure sovereignty over the history of the nations. pure sovereignty. Job chapter 12, verse 23, verse 14, verse 5. Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9. Psalm 74, verse 17, and that's just a smattering. But God is so sovereign over the history of the nations. It didn't just happen. They didn't pull up themselves by the bootstraps. This is God's sovereignty at work here. And then notice what he does. He goes full circle back to verse 18. Because what we come here, before I get there, I want to mention verse 28. Before we get there, I want to mention verse 28. Because what he does is he quotes their own writers. He quotes their own writers. And some people, I had read a couple of commentaries that made mention of commentaries that said, this was terrible. He should never have done. What's terrible about it? It's truth. In him we live and move and have our being. Now that was being spoken of by Zeus. But the truth of it is, it's speaking of God, isn't it? Of God creator, of God sovereign man, God giver of common grace. And he said, even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. And again, this was a poet that was written to some god, I'm not sure what, which god. But what he does here, he quotes their own writers in a very well-informed, intelligent, respectful way. And he basically says, you got it in you. You know that. It's there within you. It's there within you. We could even go to Titus chapter 1, verse 12, when he's writing to Titus, he says, you know what the Cretans say about themselves, and he tells something that the Cretans say about themselves, but that's not out of the question is what I'm getting at. That's not out of the question to say that. Now, and when we come to verse 30, we have a distinctly Christian appeal now. And we go full circle back to verse 18. Look at what he says. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. He goes right back to talking about Jesus and the resurrection. So he comes full circle. That's his invitation. That's his invitation here. And Matthew Henry says what we see, well, now when they heard, well, let's read verse 32. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, we will hear you again about this. So Paul went out from their midst, but some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysius the Areopagite. That means he was high up in their official, I call it a think tank. Because when they'd go up there, they would talk, they would talk about things and whatnot. Their think tank. He was someone that was evidently higher up there. And a woman named Damaris and others with him. And you notice what I've written down here. Matthew Henry says the apostle was treated with more civility at Athens than some places.
Mm-hmm. That's unusual.
Yeah. This was not intended to be, even though it was the Areopagus, it was not intended to be a court where they were judging you. But it was a think tank place where the intelligentsia went. And you notice, they weren't even that disrespectful. It says some mocked, but it says that others said, we want to hear a little more about this. Let's hear some more about this. Let's hear some more about this. All right, I want to get the handouts now. Just don't turn them over until we... No, it's not a test. Don't get scared. It's not a test. I wish Millie was here, because I told her when she started saying something, I said, hold on to that for next week. Remember?
Yeah, in our discussion time.
Yeah. I said, hold on to that for next week. Okay. Now we've got it. Everybody turn it over. Teacher mom. Yeah. Look at this. One of the often repeated statements in support of evolution is the claim that the chimp DNA is 97% similar to human DNA. Remember Millie saying that? Mm-hmm. This is considered by many as proof of our evolutionary origin. Yet textbooks omit the following perspectives as they lead students toward only evolutionary conclusions. A Corvette and a Volkswagen could be considered 97% similar depending upon the features selected. Yet one did not evolve from the other, but both exist because they were designed and built by intelligent people. The DNA similarity is required for survival in similar environments. If humans were totally different than other forms of life, what would they eat and how could they process food? All right, now consider this sentence. Many scientists reject evolution because it lacks evidence, contradicts laws of science, and is the foundation of atheism. Here's the other one. Not many scientists reject evolution because it lacks evidence, contradicts laws of science, and is the foundation of atheism. This mere 3% difference, 3 out of 102 letters, totally changed the meaning, the function, the purpose of the sentence. Furthermore, the amount of information contained within 3% of our total DNA code is equivalent to thousands of pages of specific instructions. A 3% difference is not a small change, but an enormous amount of information which could never have arisen by chance mutational changes. Now that's something to think about. That's something to consider. Let's see, here's my notes. Excuse me for a minute here. Let me remind you of something. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Eternity into man's heart. There's a sense of something before and a sense of something to come. Ecclesiastes 7:29 says, see, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. So I would say that one of the things that has come out, one of the things that has come out of stuff is, or that has come out of this is talking about evolution. Because what's some of the philosophy? Paul went head on with the philosophers, and today one of the philosophies that we go head on with is indeed evolution. And what I do want to point out is that this account was Luke's summarization of what Paul's words were. He wasn't there, but Paul retold him, gave him an account of what he did, and he wrote it down. Now, this is deology, and I want you to understand that. But because the Areopagus was such a think tank, you know, I imagine they had some Q&As. They probably had some questions and answers. There was probably even more discussed about it. But that's just something that I had wanted to take into consideration. Now look at your next one of the genetics. And I'm only going to read the first part because I have always considered myself a G-rated speaker as opposed to R-rated. So we're only going to get into the first part. You can read the rest yourself. If human similarity to apes is evidence that an ape-like creature evolved into man, why aren't the vast differences between man and ape accepted as evidence that man did not descend from apes? The human nose is totally different from that of primates. Man's lips are formed differently. Apes have thumbs on their feet, while mankind does not. Man's head is located at a different position on the spinal cord, and human babies are far more dependent upon their mothers at birth. And as I said, you can read the rest of it. Then she, Millie also mentions something about the dogs. I don't remember exactly what it was, something about dogs. But I just present that to you. Just give that to you. And if you are one of these people, and I'm one of these people too, that like to hear the theology in song, I've given you a little thing you can look up. City of Light, there is one gospel. And you can listen to that. Just Google it and listen to it. I guess that's it. I guess that's all I want to... I guess that's all I need to say at this point.